does someone with a degree in English end up pursuing an MBA at NYU Stern? And why attend a program famous for its ties to Wall Street when you're interested in marketing? And finally, why abandon the glamorous world of beauty and luxury marketing for the, shall we say, less formal world of startups and social enterprise? These are just a few of the questions I'll ask our special guest today. Our special guest is Daria Burke, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know Daria. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. But before I start talking with Daria, I want to introduce you to a couple of resources for MBA applicants who right now, if you're listening, are probably about to or already have shifted into high gear in your MBA applications, especially if you're aiming for the round one or September-October deadlines. So what are those resources? Well, the first one is Why MBA. It's a free downloadable special report which explores the key elements in responding to the MBA goals question. And the second one is MBA essay tips for each top program. These are separate pages devoted to the application questions at different schools. And it is an ever-expanding collection of tips for the essay questions at these different top MBA programs. We'll include links to these resources in the show notes at info.accepted.com/25, because this is the 25th episode of Enriching Straight Talk. Now, I'm very pleased to introduce our multifaceted and multi-talented guest today. She has a degree in English from the University of Michigan and an MBA from NYU Stern. She has founded and co-founded startups and worked in brand management for L'Oreal and as director of marketing, makeup marketing for Estee Lauder. She has been asked to speak at top colleges like Harvard, Columbia, and Brown, and she has written for a variety of publications, including the Huffington Post, Uptown Magazine, and Black Enterprise. I'm looking forward to getting to know more about Daria, her journey to date, and her dreams for the future, and any advice she has for MBA applicants. Daria, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk, Accepted.com's podcast about graduate admissions. Thank you very much for joining me.
Linda, thank you so much for having me.
Great. Now, can you please tell us a little bit about how you got into the beauty business and then decided you wanted to pursue an MBA? Or was it luxury goods and then an MBA?
Yeah, definitely. So my decision to pursue a career in the luxury goods space started probably 3 years out of college. I was working in Washington, D.C. in marketing and business development for the architecture and interior design industry. So a very unique business culture and one that without any real exposure, most people know nothing about. So, you know, I came out of Michigan with an English literature degree, as you mentioned, had a really strong interest in writing and working in a creative environment, and found myself, you know, coming out right after 9/11 and in the architecture industry. So for me, it was more about not having the formal training in marketing, first and foremost, and then recognizing that there was a broader range of the types of marketing that you could do. So when I started thinking about what that looked like, I kept finding myself leaning towards brands and companies that really centered on women and brands that were in the luxury space. And so I think it was just my own consumer interests and passions that sort of led me specifically to that industry. And from there, it was then that I made the decision to pursue an MBA to redirect my marketing career away from professional services within architecture to luxury goods and ultimately to beauty. So for me, it was a transition made solely through business school.
Okay. And why did you choose NYU Stern, a school famous for finance, if you were interested in marketing and or entrepreneurship? Or did you already know then that you wanted to take your career in an entrepreneurial direction?
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea that I would find myself working for myself so soon after business school. I think in the back of my mind, there were these entrepreneurial interests. I actually studied marketing and strategy at Stern. And, yes, it is a school that has a really phenomenal reputation for finance, but it also has a great marketing curriculum and program.
Right.
You know, the companies that recruit there, if you think about New York Metro, you know, about 25% of Fortune 500 companies are somewhere in this metro area. So I knew that I would be geographically positioned to have access to the companies that I was interested in. And again, because I was focused on retail and on luxury and on beauty, For me, it was all about the location. So I ultimately had the very sort of high-grade problem, if you will, of choosing between Stern and Columbia. And at the time, both schools were actually only recently had made the foray into luxury goods and were building brands. And arguably, Stern was probably a little bit behind the curve. It's also a smaller program. Mm-hmm. And so I actually saw a massive opportunity for myself to, you know, sort of make a name in helping the school build a reputation for luxury goods marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the companies that I was really interested in working for, like L'Oreal, recruited there, whereas at the time they weren't actively on campus at Columbia. And I actually saw the school's reputation in finance as an asset. You know, as someone mm-hmm. who didn't study marketing or any kind of business, and didn't have that quantitative background, I actually thought, you know, it might be good to, you know, have a really strong exposure, not just to marketing, but also to finance and to financial statement analysis and, you know, things like that. And it was definitely the right decision.
That's great. I sometimes think that it's a funny problem to have, and I'm sure that plenty of people listening would have loved to have the funny problem of having to choose between NYU Stern and Columbia, as you did. But what I was thinking is that some of these schools that have such strong reputations in a specific area, like Columbia or Wharton or NYU Stern in finance or Kellogg in marketing, you know, applicants sometimes forget that they really are very, very strong in other areas too.
Absolutely. And it's also a great opportunity sometimes to build your own brand, if you will.
Yeah.
So, you know, there weren't a ton of folks going into luxury retail at that time and into beauty. And so for me, I was one of a handful. And so that was so much of a part of my brand that everyone in the school knew that that's what I was interested in. It actually makes people, you know, the ability for people to help you with the recruiting process a lot easier.
That's true. And then the other point you make, which I think is equally valid and equally important for applicants to consider, is that if you are really interested in one specific area, be it marketing, and your school is good both in that and is known for finance or, you know, something else, that will enhance your brand, your reputation, because it's going to be assumed that you not only know the thing that you focused on, but you got really good exposure to this other area that the school is known for.
Absolutely.
So I think those are both really good points for applicants listening to this podcast to consider. Now, do you have any tips for MBA applicants interested in a career in luxury goods marketing or the beauty industry? What should they do if they want to head in that direction? And again, we're talking now more about people who are either 1 or 2 years away from starting an MBA program.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you're out the gate and kind of you saw the advantage of really thinking about where you want to apply, and I say this all the time, you know, to some extent you have to put aside things like ranking.
Yes.
And focus on the schools. And you know, it's hard to say that, right? When you're thinking about an MBA, you want to go to a top.
I say it all the time.
And I fully support it, but you do, and I agree with you. You have to kind of put ranking aside, because at the end of the day, if you go to a phenomenal school in Chicago, for example, mm-hmm. and you want to work in New York in luxury, you're going to have a really hard time, because those companies in New York already have NYU and Columbia in their backyard. They're not usually traveling far. Not only are they usually not traveling far to recruit, they don't usually have that many positions that they're looking to fill every year. So, you know, for them, the selectivity, you know, is easy when you have two great schools like that in the area. And then, you know, they might go to Boston, they might go to Philly to expand their reach a little bit in terms of the recruiting efforts. But it can be really challenging. So I think sometimes folks, and, you know, and I now find myself in a position where I'm counseling people who've gone to great schools in the Midwest or, you know, maybe in the South or on the West Coast, and they're now trying to break into retail or luxury, and it's tough because it is competitive, and you know, the companies don't need to go all the way out there to do that. So that's one thing, is to really think about if this is the industry for you. You know, you got to sort of prioritize geography, and you have to prioritize the schools or the companies will actually be there looking for you and recruiting for you. That's kind of the first piece of advice. And then the second piece of advice is to just have as many conversations as you can with professionals in the industry, not only because, you know, again, it's competitive and it's a bit of a small world. People tend to know each other, which is a great thing. But also because luxury is an industry. It's not a function. And so you can go into luxury and do strategy or marketing or finance or operations. You can do consulting. You can work for a brand in-house. You can do digital. You know, the options are so vast. And so it's really important to gather that data to understand functionally what it is that you want to do just as much as, you know, the industry that you're interested in, because it can be very different. And then the last thing, and this is really specific to beauty, is that while structurally it can be very similar to more traditional CPG or consumer packaged goods companies, there are nuances that are unique to beauty, and beauty recruiters and marketers are sensitive to that. So it's going to be very difficult for you once you've gone to business school. If you do a CPG internship to then try to move into beauty. So if you want beauty, you got to go for beauty. If you want luxury or fashion, you know, or retail, you have to go for that because, again, it's so competitive that anyone who shows any sign of non-commitment to those pursuits, often, you know, they don't get the opportunity.
Right. I would assume that personal appearance is really, really important in
image is important.
Yeah. Yeah. I
definitely,
mean,
definitely.
Much more so than in other industries, say high tech in contrast.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, everybody asks, is it like the movie The Devil Wears Prada? And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's like that. It's definitely not that extreme. You know, that's fiction. But
right.
Image is important. And, image is important for any professional. But
yes.
I think where image comes into play in these industries is that you're selling image.
Yes.
You know, so not
you have
only
to be aware
are
of it.
You. Yeah, and so you have to demonstrate that you understand and that you have, that you speak that vocabulary, that you have a sensitivity to a certain level of aesthetics and luxury, you know, and the difference between calling something free versus complimentary. You know, I think there are so many little nuances like that that, you know, they're looking for. And so it is true that, you know, they want to see your personality. They want to know that you can sell yourself and sell your own image, because that gives them confidence that you can sell their brand.
Right, right, for sure. Now, I know that you've also had at least two entrepreneurial ventures that I know of from the research I did before the podcast. Do you have any tips for would-be entrepreneurs contemplating the MBA?
I would, you know, I think, and not that you have to go to business school to become an entrepreneur, but I believe that business school can really help you become a better entrepreneur or assess risk, you know, from a theoretical perspective. So much of what I learned in business school was risk assessment and data-driven decision-making, you know, and so whether I'm conducting market analysis to understand if there's white space or consumer need for a product launch, you know, I know that I can take appropriate risk because I learned how to approach business judgment and decision-making. But then practically speaking, you know, I, of course, you know, also studied entrepreneurship with professors like Glenn Okin and Scott Galloway at NYU in particular. And, you know, these are professionals who have lots of startup experience, starting their own ventures, investing in others, board experience, you know, managing growing companies. You know, I think the thing that business school cannot teach you as an entrepreneur is risk tolerance. Right. So you can learn risk assessment, but you can't learn risk tolerance. That's something that you either have or you don't. And we all have a certain level of it. You know, and I think our experiences sort of dictate our risk profiles, if you will, and render us able to handle the rigors and the uncertainty of entrepreneurship. But again, I think, you know, in school, what you learn is to be able to make the decisions that allow you to feel more comfortable taking risk sometimes, and or how to mitigate risk. and how do you manage through uncertainty? Because that's a guarantee as an entrepreneur that things will be uncertain and sometimes risky and scary, and you will not have all the answers. But having the training in how to think about those problems, I think is phenomenal. And so I would say to anyone considering entrepreneurship post MBA to again really focus on schools where entrepreneurship is lauded, is taught, you know, Stanford, Stern, Harvard, you know, schools that are really have deep expertise and deep connections to the private equity and to the venture capital communities that have incubators and, you know, great programs, business plan competitions, you know, all of those things. And many schools have them. Some are just, you know, more robust, potentially more developed than others, and they have the reputation for putting out strong entrepreneurs, especially in innovation spaces. So, you know, I would just say to study it just as much as you would any other area, but also to round out those skills with strategy and marketing and finance, because, again, as an entrepreneur, you'll be exposed to so many other things. And while your functional expertise might not be in finance, it's going to be important to understand financial statements and the analysis around it and to be able to have a conversation with your CFO.
Of course. Well, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, you really have to, at some point, you're going to do it all. And you have to understand it all. At least be conversant in really all business functions.
For sure.
How did you come to start Black MBA Women, which was, I think, your second entrepreneurial venture, right?
Yeah, so my first was actually, I wasn't one of the co-founders. I was one of the 10 original members of Rent the Runway,
okay.
Which is a really phenomenal business model, and it was born from two young ladies out of Harvard, and I joined them just 2 months after launch, after the company had launched several years ago, and helped them build a couple of businesses, revenue streams, and all of that good stuff. And that was really my first foray into entrepreneurship for someone else, technically. Black MBA Women was such an accident. It was born from this natural inclination that I have to connect people.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been that way. I'm always the one, you know, I'd love to introduce you to this person. I really think you should meet this person. And so, you know, having the experience of being one of 9 Black women in my class of 411 students
uh-huh.
at NYU, you know, that was a very, to some extent, can be a very isolating experience. Now,
yeah.
I was very active on campus, very involved. I still am. I sit on the Stern alumni board, and so I'm always there. They can't get rid of me. But, you know, I recognize that experience of being one of 9 and being, a, you know, 2% of the population was something that certainly my friends who had gone to Kellogg and Harvard and Columbia and Booth and Stanford also experienced, and in talking to them, that was true. So originally my thought was just to build a community of women and build a really strong network of these women, because I thought we should all know each other. You know, my estimates for how many of us, you know, might exist from, let's say, the top, like, 25 schools over the last 10 years, you know, there can't be more than, there might be 10,000 of us, if I'm being a little bit liberal in my estimation. And
mm-hmm.
so that was really how it started. And I was at Estee Lauder at the time working as the director of makeup marketing for the North America business on the Estee Lauder brand. And Black MBA Women kind of started to snowball. You know, I started
really?
Getting a lot of interest. And, yeah, a lot of women who were like, oh, my God, this is great. This is exactly the platform that we wanted. And, you know, what are you going to do about it?
Right,
kind of
right.
And I said, oh, you're right. I guess I actually have to do something. And so I spent probably 4 months, you know, sort of taking their temperature through surveys, through events and things like that to understand actually what they wanted. You know, what was the appetite predominantly for? And so after 4 months of doing both, and doing research and exhausting myself, I decided to take the leap and really try to build something that would be not just a network, but really a platform, a media platform. So we deliver content both online and offline community, obviously, and then career development events and opportunities for Black women from top business schools. And so it's been great, but it was a total accident. It was never something that I sat down. You know, I wasn't sitting down 5 years ago thinking, you know, in about 5 years, I think I'm going to start this, you know, this enterprise for women. I think it was just this natural desire to have the social networks that I had already built function, you know, have a high functioning and really effective. I think there's so much influence and power amongst this community of women, and so I want to be able to leverage that and do really great things.
Right. You remind me of a story. This was, it's about 10 years ago now. We were at some friends for dinner, and my then 19-year-old daughter had just started. I think she declared her major as a business major at college. And we were at these friends for dinner, and she turned to me and she said, "Mom, do you have a business plan for Accepted?" And Accepted was already in existence. It was doing well. It was profitable. It was growing. Everything was good. And I said, "No, I don't." She says, "Mom, you're doing it all wrong. You should have a business plan. If you don't have a business plan, you're not running your business well." I mean, she's going on and on and on like this, as only a teenager could. And our host said to her, she says, "Wait a second. Doesn't your mom have a profitable business?" "Yeah." "And is it growing?" "Yeah." "Then maybe she has a plan in her head and she doesn't need a formal business plan." You know, then maybe she's doing something right. Now, I'm not an advocate for not having a business plan. That's not the point here. But it's like sometimes things grow. You recognize a need or demand in the marketplace. And whether you have the plan in your head or you research it carefully, and it may not be what you planned, but it might be what you were meant to do. You know what I mean? That kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. And eventually I did have to put pen to paper, right? But it was something that, again, it was necessitated by the fact that it was actually growing and that there were these women showing up. And I was, you know, kind of like, oh, well, okay, I really actually need to think about this. And so after doing that, you know, and then that's what really sort of allowed me to take the decision to quit my job, having a plan and having a sense of what my sources of revenue would be and, you know, what partnerships I thought I could strike. And even then, even having a plan, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, sometimes you still pivot, you know, because at the end of the day, I am now, it's a media brand. It's a media platform. We're producing content.
Yes.
We are, you know, looking at branded content opportunities and working with partners in ways that have, you know, less maybe to do with like recruiting or retention of these women in the community, but it's engagement for other reasons. And so, you know, that's part of it too, is being flexible, being a little bit agile, and being open to opportunities as the business kind of requires you to be able to flex in that way.
Right. And I really have, I'm definitely not saying you shouldn't have a business plan. That's not my point. It was just that sometimes opportunities come up, you know, and
and it's not always linear.
Right. Absolutely. Now, our listeners are from all over the world and definitely from both genders. And there are ethnic associations, alumni groups, professional networks, religious organizations, and they are all networks. Now, I realize you are establishing Black MBA Women as both a media platform and a networking organization. But I want to ask you, just looking at the networking aspect for the moment, and everybody's supposed to network, and I even have people tell me that they want to get an MBA, and their primary reason is a network, which I don't think is a terribly good reason, but whatever. What is the advantage of getting involved? I think it's a terribly expensive way to get a network. What is the advantage of getting involved in a network as you have gotten involved and really taken a leadership role in the African-American businesswoman's network? Is it purely a labor of love? Or do you feel it is also professionally beneficial to you? And if so, how so?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's a labor of love. As I mentioned before, I was born a connector. And I'm sure I probably would have set up my parents if I were born. You know, I think it's just what I do. So it's definitely a labor of love. I think it's in the blood. But it's incredibly beneficial. I cannot tell you the vast amount of men, of women, of all ages, of all ethnic backgrounds, from different countries, all that have sort of resulted from me starting this organization, because I don't just interact with Black women. Obviously, that's the community that I'm looking to serve at this time.
Right.
But in order to build my business and to have access to, you know, conversations with potential brand partners and all of that, I mean, I'm talking to everyone. And yes, I have been able to expand my own network beyond the Stern and the Beauty Networks, which are already quite strong and quite large, to something else that's just becoming really interesting. You know, the startup community is now something that is sort of a part of my world. Blacks mm-hmm. in technology is something that has now kind of cropped up that I never would have really had access to if I were still in the beauty industry, because it was something that would have been much, much more on the periphery of what I did for a living. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there are so many organizations and groups out there that are committed to increasing the number of women in entrepreneurship or in investing or in, you know, the startup world in general, and having, you know, forays now into those as well. It's been incredible. And everyone, what I found too is that I think people, regardless of their personal associations, we generally just want to help each other, and have, you know, I've found that folks have been just so helpful and so
yeah.
engaged with what I'm doing. You know, and I think, and it's something that I say to people all the time, if you have an idea, because a lot of times people want to hold on to it. They're like, well, it's not trademarked and I'm not ready and I can't talk about it. I talk to everybody about what I'm doing mm-hmm. because you never know who will hear what you're doing and up what you're up to and decide to make an introduction to someone else. You know, and so I tell everyone, I talk to everyone, I welcome conversations with everyone. Obviously, you have to prioritize, and that
yes.
becomes challenging
yeah.
at a certain point, which I'm sure you can appreciate. People love free advice.
Oh, gosh.
But I do love talking to people and engaging them, and so it's been tremendous for me.
Okay, fantastic. I mean, I think the main point of my question, and you definitely have answered it, is whatever group you identify with, you know, it's if you go with the idea of contributing to that group, to helping the mm-hmm. next person, while that may not be your motivation, it will pay dividends. It will benefit you too. Maybe not every single individual interaction, but the overall effect will be positive on a professional level. And I almost hate to mix, you know, altruistic behavior with, well, is it going to come back and benefit me? You know, kind of a calculating approach. But we do have to prioritize, and we have many demands on our time. And networking can be such a nebulous term for time wasting, you know, that I think,
right.
you know, sometimes it's good to discuss whether, yeah, is it really a good use of time? And the answer, I personally believe, is yes. You have to choose your networks, and as you say, you have to prioritize. But, you know, labors of love can also can bear fruit.
Absolutely. Now, and I think it's relationship management, you
yeah.
know, more than it is anything else.
Yeah, and it's prioritizing, again, as our networks expand. I mean, one of the effects, I think, of the social media, of the electronic media that we have access to, is that we can sustain larger networks. I'm not sure, you know, we can maintain the quality of relationships. I'm not sure if we're always sometimes confusing quantity and quality of relationships.
Yeah.
With, you know, via electronic media. But that's a whole other topic. And I think in terms of the value of networking and involving yourself in a network, whatever that may be, you certainly address that question. Now, you wrote, I was preparing for our call today, and I read your article, I Can Have It All, for Uptown Magazine. And I got to ask you, as you know, I was going to ask, why did you write that article?
Yeah, so I wrote that article, it's about a year ago now, and I'm in my early 30s,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm at an age where many of my friends are married and starting families and really struggling with this idea of managing career and home and integrating work and life. You know, I hate word balance, right, work-life balance, but, really trying to integrate, better integrate their professional and their personal lives. And I don't...
You cut out there for 1 second. If you could just repeat what you were saying.
Oh, sure. So I was saying that I think so many of... I'm at the age where so many of my friends I'm finding are struggling with integrating work and life. And mm-hmm. For me, and it's probably a little unfair that I would write this article, given that I am single and that I have no children.
Right.
But I do think that it's important.
Again, you just cut out. I'm sorry. You just had said I'm single, and then I lost you.
Oh, that's strange. Okay, I was saying I'm single and I have no children, so
right.
It's slightly unfair for me to write such an article. And if I were to write it today, I probably would say I can have what I want.
Okay.
So that's really the question. It's not the question of can I have it all, because what is all, right? I mean, that's a very personal idea. Generally, we mean husband, children, career,
mm-hmm.
but not everyone wants that. And so I think the question isn't, can you have it all? It's, can you have what you want?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the article really with that in mind. And I also wrote it with the, I guess, secondary goal of encouraging women to think about really managing their own lives and their own careers and knowing that they can't rely solely on institutions to give them the answer. I think we have a ways to go before companies are in a position to, and even if they decide, and the question is, should they, integrate and help employees better integrate work and life? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's not their job. That's not why companies exist. And
right.
So that's the MBA capitalist part of Daria that's speaking, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that they're going to have to figure something out as the workforce shifts, as Gen Y has different expectations, et cetera. So for me, it's really a little bit of a rally to women to say, we can make these decisions for ourselves, and we can try as much as we can to, rely on outside forces or external forces. Easier for us, but it's really up to you to sort of redefine what you think that means, and to also understand, as Ursula Burns says, and I love it, as she says, yes, you can have it all on average over time. So, not all at once. On average over time, yes, you can. But it's really like it's really more about can you have what you want? I do think that answer is yes, but I think you have to first know what that is. And then figure out the plan for how to get it.
That's right. I think that, first of all, about having what you want on average, my husband is an actuary, and he likes to tell a joke about an actuary saw somebody with his with 1 foot in an ice bucket and 1 foot in boiling water and said, on average, he's just fine. He's comfortable. I think that kind of goes along with that line. And I would agree that you have to first define, I like much better, you can have what you want some of the time, provided that you have the skills to get what you want, and also that you know what you want, and you make the choices that are best suited to making that happen. I do also think you need a certain amount of luck or blessing to get what you to do that, but it certainly helps to know what direction you want to go in.
Absolutely.
And by the way, I have 5 children, grown children.
So, oh my goodness!
Yes.
Superwoman.
I don't know about Superwoman. I wasn't working when they were young, and then at a certain point I started what became Accepted when some of them were still quite young, toddlers really, preschool age, and then grew Accepted as they grew and ultimately moved out of the house. But I think you alluded to this point in one of your articles, that entrepreneurship can be a marvelous avenue for women with young children to integrate or balance, whatever you want to call it, family life and professional aspirations. That certainly it was my experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that you're writing a series for Black Enterprise on the value proposition of the MBA. Are you happy you pursued an MBA, and do you feel it's paying off for you?
Oh, absolutely. I can't even imagine what my career might look like today had I not gone to business school. For me, the decision calculus, and again, it's always going to depend on your personal circumstances.
Right.
But for me, the decision to go to business school was definitely rooted in the desire to change my career, to some extent functionally, but really from an industry perspective, to actually develop a business acumen and a vocabulary and a perspective that I didn't have coming from a really strong liberal arts program at Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, you know, to gain more access and to build my network. But I was also, again, I was younger, I was single, you know, I didn't have some of the responsibilities that some of your audience might have. And so
right.
you do have to take those into consideration. And so for me, it was almost a no-brainer, despite the expense that does come along with it, because the return on the investment, I think, is more than a hundredfold. It's been incredible for so many reasons, and I am still very much a proponent, despite a lot of the media and a lot of the conversations that are happening around the value of an MBA. I'm still very much a proponent of going to business school, you know, if and when it makes sense. Obviously, you got to do your homework.
Right. I'm sometimes amazed at the media that says, well, you know, The sky is falling. The ROI on the MBA degree has declined since 2000, and it's not climbing like it has done in the past several years. I'm like, you know, it really doesn't matter. What matters is today is, are you as an MBA applicant or an MBA student likely to have a positive ROI, and is the degree likely to allow you to achieve your goals for that degree, for this education, for this investment? And if it's positive, then frankly, it doesn't matter that 10 years ago it might have been higher. You weren't around 10 years ago to make the decision.
Exactly. Well, and to be fair, a lot of these, and this is probably, you know, it may be a slightly controversial statement, but a lot of the folks writing these articles are journalists.
Yes.
and actually don't have the experience of having gone through it, and therefore they don't have the experience of seeing the benefit, the real benefit.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, a grain of salt. That's going to be true for anything. you know, so it's always funny to read journalists writing about business versus business people writing about business.
But some of the criticism has come from people who've gone to business school too, but I'm always amazed at that particular form of criticism, especially given the data on alumni satisfaction, which is so overwhelmingly positive.
Which is really positive for sure. I think, you know, and the other controversial statement I'll make is that not all MBAs are created equal.
Of course.
So I think that sometimes, and I've heard this as well, folks who aren't happy with their experiences now post-MBA or don't feel that they have seen the return on the investment, it's often folks who didn't necessarily either pursue the right business school or didn't really think about how to leverage their MBA to enhance their career in the first place.
I agree. So we're both making controversial statements. Okay. Do you have any tips for MBA applicants, either in terms of choosing the programs to apply to? I think you kind of just hinted at that one, or in terms of completing the MBA application.
Absolutely. Well, research is so important, and I think that's why what you do is really great, because you provide so much information and so many resources for making that decision. But I would say that at the outset, I think a lot of times MBA programs, especially top business schools, they seem very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're on the website and you're reviewing student placement statistics, and you know, I think once you really start to dig into it, you'll find that they're, again, they're not all the same. And so you should be evaluating them not just on the rankings, as I mentioned earlier, but on the, all of the qualitative factors, the curriculum, the specializations that they offer, the industries for which they're best known,
right,
the career opportunities, the extracurricular opportunities. You know, if you, again, if you really wanted to go into retail, you're going to have a really hard time doing that coming out of certain schools. And I don't care how great the school is, if they're not known for that industry, or if geographically it doesn't work. And so fit is one of those really nebulous words that we throw around a lot about the MBA, but it's so important. You're going to spend 2 years of your life if you do a full-time program, 3 if you're potentially doing part-time, you know, with these people and in this community, and it's something that becomes a part of your brand for the rest of your life. So, you know, you have to decide, do you want large or small programs? Do you want something that's collaborative or competitive? Do you want an active social life while you're there? Do you want to be in a city that allows you to readily travel? Because, I traveled a lot when I was in business school, so living in New York made that very easy. You know, all those kinds of things come into play and sort of category. So I would just continue to challenge folks to really think about that, think about those factors as well as some of the other, you know, more quantitative types of things. And in terms of applications, you know, it's an exhaustive process that requires significant preparation. And I personally spent a little over a year preparing all in for my application. And so that meant studying for the GMAT. It meant actually taking a class at Kaplan. You know, it meant really thinking about my recommenders and, you know, my essays and all of that. And so I think, you know, it also makes the application process slightly easier if you really know that the school that you're applying to will be an asset to you in your career. If you're applying because the rankings are strong and that's kind of your leading motivation, it's going to be a harder sell to say why that school is the right fit for you. So, you know, you're doing yourself a favor by doing the research and those visits and talking to alumni and all of those things. And sometimes it boils it down to a really short list, you know, in the end. I know folks who started with 8 schools and wound up applying to 3 because of the research. And,
right,
you know, that's important.
Yeah, for sure. There's no point in applying to schools you don't want to attend. I think that's just a mistake. Now, and you hear about that. I mean, every so often, and we'll work with somebody, and they'll get in and they'll say, you know, I don't think I want to go to this school. It's like, it's almost, it reminds you of the Groucho Marx line, I wouldn't attend a place that would accept me. I mean, okay. Okay.
Exactly. And those are usually the people who don't know how to optimize the degree once, you know, and the experience of being there once they're there, because you can get really lost in it really quickly, I think.
If you don't have a good sense of direction, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think that's the other reason that it's so important, which is something that I'm, you know, talking until I'm blue in the face about. It's really important to know what you want to get out of the degree. Well, I would say before you apply, but certainly before you arrive, because otherwise, you know, if you know what you want to get out, it will help you help guide your decision in terms of school choice. It will make you a more compelling applicant, and it will allow you to prioritize much more effectively once you arrive on campus. Now,
absolutely.
I think our podcast is just about over, Daria. How can people learn more about you and your work and Black MBA Women?
Well, they can go to blackmbawomen.com and learn all about the network, see the types of content that we produce and that we aggregate, and they can certainly read more about me there. Google is also a great handy tool when in doubt. You know, my name is Daria Burke, and it's pretty unique. So I'm really easy to find on the web in general. And you can follow me on Twitter @Daria Burke.
And I've done so.
Black MBA Women.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. Yes, we follow each other.
Right. Right. We'll include a link in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/25, both to Daria's site and to the MBA admissions resources I mentioned earlier, as well as to a few of Daria's articles that I mentioned in the course of today's show. Daria, thank you so much again for joining me here today and sharing your story and insights. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners will too once they get to hear it. Listeners, thank you too for joining us today for this, our 25th episode. As always, please share your feedback. 5-star reviews on iTunes are particularly welcome. You can leave any kind of feedback on iTunes, the blog, or by emailing me at linda@accepted.com. And if you're not a subscriber, you can subscribe either through iTunes, Stitcher, or Zune. So please, do that. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by accepted.com. And I am your host, Linda Abraham. One more time, Daria, thank you so much for joining me. And I'll talk to you, our listeners, again in 2 weeks.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.